Hello, welcome to the Eating for Health podcast. I'm Dr. Harriet Holm, founder of Healthy Eating Doctor, registered nutritionist and doctor. I studied medicine at Cambridge University, worked in the NHS for over a decade, have a PhD in genetics, lecture on nutrition, and was commissioned to write a novel degree combining culinary skills, nutrition and health. I'm on a mission to break down nutrition myths and share science-backed nutrition to help empower you. I'll share some interviews, theories and practical tips focused around nutrition and health. Stay tuned to find out more. I was really delighted to welcome on this week Dr. Zareen Sheikh, a consultant cardiologist. Zareen and I share the same ethos, and she's also a passionate advocate for optimising well-being to prevent disease and live happier, healthier lives. Zareen qualified from the University of Nottingham 2001 and has been working on the front line of the NHS since. In 2008, the British Heart Foundation awarded her a grant to undertake a PhD researching sleep, cardiac physiology and lung disease. Her PhD sparked an ongoing interest in the role of sleep and heart health. In 2017, she qualified as a consultant and now works between the community and St Peter's Hospital in Chertsey. Throughout her years as a doctor, she's seen patients getting younger and sicker. Cardiac disease is still the world's leading cause of death, and in the UK kills more women per year than breast cancer. This motivated her to develop the Fresh Heart Project, a platform for positive, accurate health messages to address the root causes of heart disease. She shares evidence-based tools to refocus your energy and optimise your health without judgment and with compassion. Find her at freshheartproject.com and follow her at both Fresh Heart Project and Fresh Heart Doc. I'm really delighted to have Zareen come to speak to me today, and she's a consultant cardiologist and is really passionate about preventative medicine. And just ask her to introduce herself.
Oh, thank you so much, Harriet. Thank you for having me on your podcast. It's a real pleasure to be here. Yes, my name's Zareen. I'm a consultant cardiologist. Now it's coming up to nearly 20 years since I qualified, 20 years of being on the front line of the NHS. And more recently, I have become really passionate about preventative medicine, specifically things that we can do ourselves, small sustainable steps to help empower us to live better, healthier, happier lives. And that inspired me to develop the Fresh Heart Project, which is the medium through which I spread those messages.
And I love reading about your Fresh Heart Project on your website, and I'll pop some links to that in the show note. But can you just tell me a bit about how you conceived it, what does Fresh stand for, and what sort of your mission is with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you speak to a lot of people in this space, they always have a personal journey. And I've certainly got my own personal journey involving, you know, I mentioned earlier, I've now, it'll be 20 years coming up to being on the front line of the NHS. And that's very busy, stressful, quite demanding. And that certainly takes its toll. And it took its toll on me about four years ago, I would say, when I completely burnt out. I not only got symptoms such as brain fog, where I couldn't really remember the next bit of my sentence. I was getting anxious. I was having sleepless nights, but I also had physical symptoms, and physical symptoms that I had to start medication for. I even had to spend, you know, a night in hospital. It really wasn't like me. I had loads of investigations. No one could really get to the bottom of what was going on, but offered more medication. And it wasn't really until a friend of mine said, but Zareen, are you actually sleeping? Are you actually eating? Are you like, what are you eating? Are you looking after yourself? I realized that no, I wasn't looking after myself. I wasn't focusing on me. I was so busy, as we do, of trying to juggle everything, that I was totally neglecting myself. And as a result, I was getting all the symptoms that I talked about. And I slowly but surely started looking after myself. So after my training finished, so I became a consultant in 2017, I decided to take a little bit of a break, Small changes, I would say, to start with, just looking at what I was eating, how I was exercising, making sure I slept. And honestly, they revolutionized my life. I found I was sleeping much better. I was feeling much better. I was much more energetic. And my symptoms went. And I didn't need all those medications. And, you know, luckily I was in that category where my symptoms were just related to the way I was not really looking after myself, and I could reverse them, because that's not always the case. But it really was a eureka moment for me, because I then started looking at my patients slightly differently, and I'd spent ages in clinic with them talking about underlying root causes of blood pressure and what were they eating, were they sleeping, were they stressed, and I was getting quite amazing results. So people were coming back after, you know, just making tiny small changes, like joining a football team or, you know, cutting out fizzy drinks, with, you know, genuine improvements in blood pressure and genuine improvements in heart rhythm issues. And so that really inspired me to focus on prevention and looking at what root causes are causing the issues that I see in my clinical practice. And that led me to develop the Fresh Heart Project. And that sort of became the inspiration tool, really.
And I think it's really inspiring. And as you say, it doesn't really matter whether you're a doctor or whether you're a busy mum or you're busy in your career or you're just busy. Life is so busy. It's so 24 hour now. And I think for many people, it's not that uncommon to really put yourself at the bottom of that list of priorities. And certainly I remember as a junior doctor, well, even, you know, a more senior doctor, being on the wards overnight. And the only thing available was sort of, you know, junk food or a can of fizzy drink. You obviously brought your own food in, but it's really hard looking after yourself when you're doing shift work. And whether that's because you're a lorry driver or because you're a nurse or a doctor, the stress, you know, the change in your body clock, eating different food at different times, it's all really hard as well. And I think that must take a toll over time. And certainly, you know, there's evidence to show that your increased risk of things like breast cancer, if you're a shift worker because of your circadian rhythm, your natural body clock and the hormone melatonin. So it's kind of almost unsurprising that shift workers and doctors as a whole are so unhealthy in general, and that we should be looking after ourselves even more because we're doing all that. But it's so hard to do when it's a demanding job. You're busy, the bleep's going off the whole time. You're just struggling to find time to, you know, to go to the loo, let alone eat your vegetables and eat well. So I think it's a shame that for you it had to come to that point where it all sort of imploded. But it's fantastic that you're now taking that on and are trying to help people. So tell us all what FRESH stands for.
Yeah, thank you. So FRESH came to me one day when I was thinking about what the real underlying pillars of good health are. And FRESH became an acronym for what I believe is a sort of good basis of good health. So F stands for food and good nutrition, which you talk about so eloquently. R stands for relaxation, and with that comes stress management. E stands for exercise and just keeping moving. S stands for sleep, and my PhD was in sleep, so it's a kind of particular pet topic of mine. And H used to be happiness, but I think that I changed it. And really, I changed it because I think happiness as a goal is not a good thing to focus on, because we're not always happy. So that changed into honesty, and honesty with compassion, because all health changes need to start with us being honest with ourselves about what we can do, what we want to do, what fits in our life, what fits with our finances. And then compassion underlies all of that. Self-compassion is key, because being in a particular position is nobody's fault, and understanding that is a really good basis to build on.
No, absolutely, and I think that's really important, and it has to be it has to be sort of be individualized, that it fits with you at the right time, and sort of pragmatic approach. Nobody's perfect, we're all human, and it's about, you know, working out what that is for you and fitting it in with best practice. So I know that cardiovascular disease is obviously a huge area. Are you able just to sort of tell us briefly what cardiovascular disease is?
Yeah, so cardiovascular disease is a big umbrella term. Cardio stands for the heart, and vasc stands for blood vessels. So it's the heart and all the associated blood vessels, or the tubes carrying blood to and from the heart. And cardiovascular disease encompasses lots of different things that affect not only the heart, but they affect the blood vessels. So, for example, strokes and blood vessel disease in your legs, that all comes under this big umbrella term. As cardiologists, we like to focus on the heart aspect of it, which is predominantly issues to do with either the actual structure, or the pipes, the tubes, the arteries that supply the heart muscle, or the electrics, and those, or the muscle. And those are the real sort of broad categories of heart disease that we talk about.
So I know that breast cancer is obviously a really, everyone knows about breast cancer. There are so many breast cancer charities, which is, you know, really fantastic. I worked, my PhD was in a lab funded by a breast cancer charity, and was most people working on breast cancer. The BRCA2 gene was discovered by my supervisor. So I you know, understand how important breast cancer is. But what I find really surprising is that more women die from cardiovascular disease each year than breast cancer. And yet it just doesn't feel as though it's as well popularized, or that people are as concerned about it, maybe. And so what can we do to help improve our long-term health and reduce cardiovascular disease? Because unlike breast cancer, it's possibly, you know, more modifiable. You may be more able to prevent it than breast cancer.
You're absolutely right, Harriet. It is. I was even shocked as a cardiologist to find out that heart disease kills more women in the UK than breast cancer does. And it's because we don't associate, typically we don't associate heart disease with women. We all, when we think of people having heart attacks, we think of a male with a tight belt, or a, you know, something sitting on the chest, a sweaty and, you know, in pain. We don't often think about women. And there are studies to show that actually when women present to hospital with signs and symptoms of a heart attack, that it's not recognized. And it's not, even by the medical community, it's not recognized early, and it's not picked up early. So there's work to be done within the medical community for us to recognize it. But also as women, because we're relatively protected by the effects of estrogen up until the menopause, when we lose that, our risk goes to, and it becomes similar to men. And because we've been relatively protected, it's easier for us to not really think about it or to discount it, even amongst ourselves. And women also present with not always typical symptoms. So whilst men present quite typically with central crushing chest pain, women will sometimes have, you know, a bit of indigestion or an odd shoulder ache or something really non-specific going on. And it's not always that easy to pin it down. So having a high index of suspicion is really important. And so what I always, and so there's a problem in appreciation of the stereotype. There's a problem with us recognizing it in hospital. So I think as women, what we need to do is do as much as we can within our control to prevent it. And then just to have an eye out for those red flag signs and symptoms to say nothing's quite, I think something's not quite right. And, you know, I think I see a lot of women in my clinical practice who have odd chest pains, odd palpitations, and most of the time they're nothing. Most of the time I can reassure them, but it is important to get tested and to seek help initially from a GP. And if your GP is concerned, they'll refer on to someone like us to do further tests. And I will always do further tests because I think it's important to exclude something and then to reassure. So if you're worried, get tested, and then think about all the things that we talked about in the fresh algorithm, and have a think about what you can do to optimize your own primary prevention risk of having that event.
Great, thank you. And so you mentioned that your PhD was on sleep. Can you tell us a little bit more about the importance of sleep and any tips that you might have.
Yeah, absolutely. Goodness, I love this topic. I can talk about it all day. So yeah, please stop me when I carry on about it too much. So sleep is, goodness, it is a bit of a miracle healer, really. It's a control alt delete of our system. And it's gaining a lot more recognition now, which I think is really important. There's a lot more awareness about how we're not sleeping so well as a society. And I think that's excellent. Now, sleep, when you ask how much should we sleep, that's often quite a loaded term because it's like saying, what's your shoe size? It's what normal for you. And what I may need is maybe very different to what, you know, a young, athletic, you know, 21-year-old needs. It changes over your life and it changes with different types of people and changes if you're more active or less active. So it's not so much that you need a rigid amount of sleep. It's that you need the right amount of sleep and good quality sleep for you. And what that will do is it, from a cardiac perspective, it allows the heart to rest. It gives you cardiac metabolic restoration. If you get enough sleep, then what happens is that you don't have that overdrive of stress response. If you don't have enough sleep, your stress response goes on to a little bit of a chronic overdrive. So over time, you get small elevations in your heart rate and small elevations in your blood pressure. And similarly, what then happens is that if you don't get enough sleep, the hormonal sort of mechanisms in your brain to cope with hunger change. So you actually become, and that it's a little bit complicated, the hormones involved are called leptin and ghrelin, but what happens is that the balance shifts. So when you wake up, you're hungry. And I mean, I don't know about anyone, but when I have woken up after a poor night's sleep, I never crave broccoli or kale. I always crave that that sugar fix of like a donut or a biscuit. And over time, that can gradually lead you to put on weight. And additionally, so you've got the chronic stress response, you've got the changes in your hormones leading you to be hungry and weight gain. And then you've also got problems with mopping up blood glucose in your system. So the sensitivity to insulin, which mops up your blood sugar, goes down. And that over time can predispose you to having diabetes. So it kind of becomes a bit of a melting pot of risk factors for developing issues to do with the heart. But it sounds very scary when I say it, but it's all reversible, it's all preventable. It's all, you know, if you've got sleep issues, there is always something that you can do to counteract them. And it's about getting the right support and the right help. Should I talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd love that. That sounds really great. So I'd just add as well, I mean, I think this topic is fascinating as well, because there's a two-way relationship between your gut and your brain. So if you're eating those nutrient-dense foods because you're stressed, you're partly more at risk of becoming obese because of your eating those, but also it has a knock-on effect with your microbiota that they then change and they then feed back to your brain to carry on eating. So it's amazing how it's all so interlinked. And then you have a hyperinflammatory, you know, that chronic inflammation state because of your gut microbiota are off. So it's you can see how it all just really feeds in. And as you say, it might feel scary and overwhelming, where on earth do I start? But I think also it means sort of you can make really small changes and they can have a profound effect because they have such a knock-on effect. And and that's really, you know, that's really reassuring. You know, make small changes, you can, you know, really have big effect. So yeah, so I'd love to hear some tips about sleep and what can you do if you say got insomnia or what Absolutely. Should you be doing?
Yeah, so I would say that if you're worried, if you are sleepy throughout the day, if you have poor quality sleep, then the important thing is to seek help. And if your GP is concerned that you've got a particular type of sleep disorder, then they will refer you to a sleep specialist for help. So it is important. There's an a very, very underdiagnosed condition called obstructive sleep apnea, where when you sleep, the muscles of your whole body relax, but the muscles of your airway relax too. And that can predispose you to developing narrowing in the airway intermittently throughout the night, which just constantly wakes you up. So you never get that deep sleep, that you never get that nourishing sleep. So that's something to get checked out if you think that that may well be something that you're suffering with or your partner's suffering with. And the red flag signs are if you've got a lot of neck weight or if you snore very heavily, and if you wake up just generally feeling unrefreshed and awful, or you can fall asleep very quickly during the day, then do just get yourself checked out. I think another real issue is insomnia. I think the pandemic, I think, has heightened our stress levels, and insomnia can be very short term. So there's a lot of short term insomnia, but insomnia can also be very chronic. And the important thing to say about insomnia is even if it's really chronic and you think that it's ruling your life, there are things that you can do to help. So there are things... Now, we often talk about things called sleep hygiene, which I would say are helpful, but when we focus on it too much, it becomes a stress in and of itself. And whilst it's helpful, it can kind of get you from, let's say, a grade B plus to an A minus. So it can put you up into kind of a little bit of help. But what you really need if you've got insomnia is something called CBTI or cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, and it is brilliant. It's evidence-based, and that you can get either through the NHS or through private means, or you can get it now via certain apps as well, which are very helpful. So I would say if you've got chronic, long-term, quite significant insomnia, then seek help for that. The other tip that would really help is what happens when we sleep is our brain is excellent at associations. So if we toss and turn in bed with our thoughts racing and we, you know, have trouble either getting to sleep, or we get to sleep and wake up in the middle of the night with our thoughts racing and we can't, you know, that kind of spirals into anxiety and stress, or even if it's just our thoughts racing, we can't get back to sleep, then our brain associates the bed with thoughts racing and the anxiety about not getting to sleep. And what the best thing to do is to create positive, healthy associations. And to do that, you need to just get out of bed. Get out of bed, go to a different room, read a book, do something else. You know, it can be anything, anything that's not particularly stimulating, like, you know, it doesn't even really matter that if it is, take time out. And then, you know, eventually if you get sleepy again, then go to your bed, and then hopefully your brain will train itself to associate bed with sleep rather than associate bed with worry. Sleep hygiene are things that can help if you're sort of low grade, recent insomnia, quite acute responses to stressful environments. Obviously dealing with the stress will help, but then looking at things like light. So having brighter light in the morning helps reset our body clocks and our circadian rhythm, which is what you mentioned earlier. So it helps us reset our body clocks, and having a darker environment in the evening helps us to reset our body clocks. So it's the contrast between the bright light of the day and the night as well that's really important. Sometimes that means, you know, putting away screens as well in the night, because screens can have a lot of that blue light that keeps us awake. So if that's something that's a problem for you, then that can be very helpful. So being very mindful of light, and in particular screens. The second thing is routine. So our bodies love routine. So if we wake up at a particular time and we generally go to sleep at a particular time, then our bodies tend to like that. The third thing is temperature. Mm-hmm. So when we were evolving as cavemen, we would wake up when the sun would rise, and when the sun would set in the evening and it would get colder and the temperature would drop, we would then go to sleep. So our bodies associate getting colder with nighttime and sleepiness. So having a bath, for example, can get rid of some of that warmth. Opening windows can be quite helpful. And then just being mindful of when you eat. So trying to eat slightly earlier in the day sometimes, being mindful of caffeine, having caffeine slightly earlier in the day if you're particularly sensitive. Those things fall under the umbrella term of sleep hygiene. But what I would say is that there's a lot of advice given about sleep hygiene, and it is very good and it is very useful. But there are people who are chronic insomniacs who are doing all of that and are still having trouble. And they then definitely need to seek help from experts who can then guide them through cognitive behavioral therapy, which I think will be much more useful for them.
Yeah, and I think it is really interesting. So thanks for those tips. And I think it is really interesting that even just a bath, because it can spike your melatonin hormone, can't it? The getting out of the bath and getting cold. So when you're falling off to sleep, and your circadian rhythm, your body clock naturally produces the melatonin, the sleepy hormone, the hormone that makes you feel sleepy, which you can, or some people do take for jet lag and things, and some chronic sleep conditions, that actually just getting out of the bath and having that temperature drop can spike that melatonin hormone and make you feel sleepy, which I think is quite amazing that it can have all those effects. So what would you say if you're a parent, you've got young children and you'd absolutely love some sleep, but you just never manage to because you're woken up all night and you've got toddlers running around all day? Have you got any tips for busy parents?
Yeah, I would say just be kind to yourself. Do what you have to do. These are difficult times. They're difficult times for everyone. And that's, you know, those periods of sleep deprivation are common to us all, and hopefully this time shall pass. As your kids get older, you'll be getting back that sleep. So just don't be hard on yourself. You know, yes, we need that sleep. Yes, we need to have our bodies restored. If you can capture it at any other point in the day in little naps, that's quite helpful as well. But just don't be hard on yourself, because this is a difficult time for us all.
So does nap sleep count just as much as
sleep
in the night? There's a sort of old wives' tales that sleep before midnight counts more than sleep after midnight. And I must say, I'm a terrible night owl. I find getting up in the morning incredibly difficult, but I'm quite happy till 2-3 a.m. at night. So is my sleep more of a poor quality then because I'm going to bed so late, or is that just what's right for me?
No, not at all. Your body knows what it's doing. Your body knows what it's doing for you. And that's the thing, to trust your body. And you may well end up, you know, being a night owl and sleeping more at night. And the world is not set up for night owls. So I do apologize. Set up morning for sort of your morning wake, early risers. So it doesn't really matter when you sleep. What you need to do is get the right amount of sleep for your body. And your body knows best. You know how much sleep you need. Now, historically, actually, we used to have two sleeps. So people used to have a portion of sleep, wake up in the middle of the night to either socialize or make love or, you know, have a chit chat, and then go back to sleep. So we didn't always have this one solid block of sleep historically, going back through evolution. And also there are lots of cultures that used to have a siesta or a nap in the afternoon, and that is very restorative. What I would say is that A, you have to do what's right for you. B, it's not always possible to have a nap or have a couple of blocks. If you can, then great. But naps are very restorative, and naps are particularly restorative when done in a particular way. So we sleep in cycles. So what happens is we have various stages of sleep throughout the night, and we cycle through those stages. And each of those stages lasts about 90 minutes or so, roughly. Now, in that 90 minutes, what happens is we go from fairly light sleep to much deeper sleep. And then that period is all called non-REM, because then we go into what we call REM sleep, or rapid eye movement sleep. Now, that whole cycle of light sleep, deep sleep, and REM sleep lasts about 90 minutes. What's interesting is that in REM, what happens is that we totally lose muscle tone and we dream. Typically, this is where it's associated with dreaming. And if you wake up in REM, then you are exhausted. Similarly, if you wake up not getting enough of that nourishing deep sleep, you're exhausted. So it's getting that balance of probably about 45 to 60 minutes of a power nap, of getting enough of that light stage sleep and deep sleep, but not quite reaching REM sleep to then have that restorative little bit of extra juice to your system. Or just sleeping through the whole sleep cycle and waiting for that 90 minutes.
And how can you tell then that you're getting enough sleep? Is that you can wake up in the morning without an alarm and you feel good? Is that the best way of telling?
Your body knows. Your body knows. So if you feel sleepy, and the other thing is to recognize the difference between fatigue and exhaustion and sleepiness. So you can be, as we were talking about earlier, being a junior doctor on the wards or just a busy mum, you know, when you're running around after your kids all day, or, you know, you're at work all day, you can be running around and then you get home in the evening and you're exhausted, you're physically exhausted, so you're fatigued, but you're not sleepy. And there's a difference between fatigue and sleepiness. And it's important to recognize the sleepiness aspect of it and the exhaustion aspect of it, because you can be exhausted for a whole number of different reasons. But if you're sleepy, then that can be a pointer towards not having enough good quality sleep. And then you can start asking a few questions about your sleeping habits.
Thank you. I think that was really useful. I know that I don't get enough sleep, and I also have from a long line of people that sleep talk and sleep walk. So I think that my sleep is probably never as not quite as restorative as it might be, because I'm off walking or talking all night. But anyway, thank you. So is there the same evidence about exercise? And can you tell us what you tell your patients about exercise? What type matters? How much should you be doing?
Yeah.
And some top tips for that too, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is very little doubt that exercise is helpful for just about any disease. It is helpful for the heart. It's helpful for the cardiovascular system, as we talked about earlier. It's helpful for it's helpful to prevent cancer. It's helpful for stress. It's helpful for weight. It's helpful for mood. It's helpful for so many different things. It's helpful for a lot of your blood markers as well. So it's helpful for blood sugars. It can be helpful partly with some blood lipids. Partly, I would say, most of your cholesterol is your genetic makeup, really, and there's not a lot you can do about it, sadly. But it's so restorative. And what I love about exercise is that what is recommended by a lot of cardiac associations and heart associations is 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise per week. So what that means is roughly half an hour for 5 days a week. And by moderate intensity, it means to the point where you can't easily talk to someone whilst you're doing that level of activity. So it could be a brisk walk for some people. For some people, it's a run. It just varies for you. And it's a mixture, I would say, of things like, things that get your heart rate up. So get your cardiovascular system working, like running or swimming, and strength exercises where you're kind of lifting weights and getting your muscles stronger. So it's a mixture of those. Now, whilst that is the recommended amount, we don't always get it. So what I love about exercise is that it has what we call this dose responsive effect, in that even a small amount has a little effect on your health. And if you step up to a bit more, then it has a bit more effect, and then a bit more has a bit more effect. So, you know, the more you do, the better it is, but even a small amount helps. So if you're not doing anything, then just getting out, getting active will help. And I always recommend this website, because I see a lot of patients who can't exercise for various reasons, be it, you know, musculoskeletal, so arthritis, joint problems, back problems, or they've got heart failure and it's really difficult. So there's a website called weareundefeatable.com, which kind of makes exercise a bit more accessible for everyone. So you don't have to be doing those high intensity workouts. You can do a little bit of something that's right for you and it will work. So that's what I would advise for people who find it difficult to exercise. If you're exercising a lot anyway, brilliant. Keep at it. You will be doing yourself and your heart a good service. If you're just finding it difficult, then there are lots of little, you know, there are lots of things out there now about how you can incorporate exercise into the day. So, you know, you can do 5 minutes in the kitchen, or you can get up from a desk, or you can, you know, you can do lots of standing. You can do a bunch of squats, you know, if you're getting tired and not thinking straight at the computer. There are lots of little things that you can do, little hacks, and they can be very helpful because staying seated all day is difficult. It's not good for your health, but it's very common because especially now with home working and compute and being at your commuter all day, having what we call a sedentary life is really, really, really common. But exercise can actually offset the harm of that sedentary life. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you just get up and you move and you do something. So I can't recommend it highly enough. I think it's very important, and it's a very important little tool that we have, but you have to do what's right for you. There's no point in looking at someone on social media or a neighbor or a colleague and thinking, oh gosh, I've got to do that like 10-mile run, because if you don't like running, then you're not going to do it. It has to be something that's fun for you, and that's the only way of making it sustainable. It kind of boils down to the H, honesty part of the FRESH acronym, that you have to just do what's right for you and not for anyone else, just you. And that's much more sustainable and enjoyable.
Absolutely. But also that you don't have to go to the gym for your minutes of exercise. You know, just 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, all count. Just running after your children or just, you know, walk around the park or walk around the block or whatever. They can all add up. And that even if, you know, some clients I've seen that have had major surgery and can't move at all, but they can still do sort of exercises in the chair. You can do what's right for you, and people's intensity and their, you know, choice is going to be entirely different. But every bit counts, and it's never too late to start, really, is it?
You know? Never.
So don't be, in the same way that don't think you've got to be 100% perfect with your diet. I'm certainly not 100% perfect. I don't think anyone is, because we're not robots, we're all humans. You don't need to be the same with exercise. It's about every little counts and those small changes really adding up.
Absolutely.
Well, it's been really insightful. I feel I've learned a lot of information, certainly stuff that I didn't know the evidence behind or quite the tips before. So, and I don't think we get taught enough about this in medicine, and that, you know, they're really simple changes that could help prevent a really important disease that affects so many people worldwide. So it's really great to see you having your mission to try to reduce cardiovascular disease and try to improve people's long-term health. So thank you so much, Erin.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
I really hope you enjoyed listening, and I'd love if you'd give me a 5-star review and subscribe so that other people can find me too. I'm also at Healthy Eating Doctor on Instagram, and I have lots more nutrition education information on both my video courses and on my website, healthyeatingdoctor.com.